You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. We've had several programs in the last couple of months on mass incarceration in the United States. Perhaps you've been here to catch some of them. James Forman was here recently on Locking Up Our Own. Danielle Allen telling her story about her cousin here in Los Angeles and his experiences with the prison system. So those might be ones you want to check out as a kind of backup to tonight's program. Where we look tonight at September 9th to September 13th, 1971, at the Attica Correctional Facility, where inmates' protests over years of mistreatment became one of the great historical tragedies of the U.S. prison system and one of the most important civil rights stories of our time. The Attica Uprising was 47 years ago, and yet it's a story that could not be more vital today in the United States, where we have more than 10 times the number of prisoners as we did at the time of Attica. So think Attica 47 years ago, think Pelican Bay today. We're very honored to welcome two scholars on mass incarceration tonight. Visiting us from the University of Michigan is Heather Ann Thompson, whose illuminating study on Attica, Blood in the Water, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize and cited by the judges, quote, for a narrative history that sets high standards for scholarly judgment and tenacity of inquiry in seeking the truth about the 1971 Attica prison riots. Heather Ann Thompson's work sheds new light on every aspect of the uprising and its legacy, giving voice to all those who took part in the 45-year fight for justice. Heather Ann Thompson's book pieces together interviews, transcripts, police reports into a gripping story. It's really hard to put it down, filled with unexpected insights. For instance, thinking about what dentures mean to the imprisoned and eyeglasses, basic human functions, eating and seeing, reminding you that this is a human rights story as well. Heather Ann Thompson grew up in Detroit in the 70s with the drug war there in full swing and the recession taking a terrible toll. She describes it as, I was growing up in the epicenter of America, a white girl in a mostly black city, trying to understand all that politically. She's written on the history of mass incarceration for numerous publications, and she's also the author of Who's Detroit? Politics, Labor, and Race in a Modern American City, and she's the editor of Speaking Out, Activism and Protest in the 60s and 1970s. She speaks internationally and nationally, presenting her work on prisons and justice policy to university and policy groups nationally and all over the world. And in conversation with Heather Ann tonight is Kelly Lytle Hernandez, a professor of history and African-American studies at UCLA. She is one of the nation's leading experts on race, immigration, and mass incarceration, that's a good one. And she's the author of the award-winning book, Migra, A History of the U.S. Border Patrol, and more recently, City of Inmates, Conquest, Rebellion, and the Rise of Human Caging in Los Angeles. She's currently the research lead for the Million Dollar Hoods Project, which maps how much is spent on incarceration per neighborhood in Los Angeles County. So without further ado, please welcome Heather Ann Thompson and Kelly Lytle Hernandez. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you for being here with us tonight. I want to be completely frank and honest with everyone, so let you know that Heather and I are dear friends, so you're going to be a part of our conversation tonight, talking about her incredible, gripping, really visceral book, Blood in the Water. So before we get started, I wanted to just take a poll of the folks who are here with us tonight about who's had a chance to read this book, and I know everyone wants to read it, but it'll give us a good sense about how deep we want to go with this conversation, what direction we want to take it. So can we get hands up for who's had an opportunity? Okay, so we have a lot of new people to the book tonight. Okay, so does that help us out? I think before we get into the book, I want to introduce you all a little bit to this amazing woman who is to my left here. You have been working for social justice for as long as I have known you. And I thought maybe we could take a little bit of time and introduce you and your upbringing and what drives you to really research race, mass incarceration, and social justice.
Well, thank you. I think the path to this is a little unusual for me, which is that I grew up in the city of Detroit. And I grew up in a city that at the time, which was the 70s and 80s, was becoming more and more reviled by the nation as sort of the armpit of the nation, the worst city on the planet, the murder capital of the world. But it became clear to me that in part that was because it was an all-black city. And I was a white kid growing up in an all-black city and went to a mostly black high school and neighborhood. And to me, it was just so kind of startling, this disconnect between the city that I grew up in, where everybody that I knew, the smartest people I knew, the teachers, the city official, everybody in my orbit was African American, and yet somehow the history books, the world, so misunderstood that. So that was my kind of entree into the kind of history I wanted to write. And then the more I dug into that history, it was just sort of this episode after episode after episode of injustice, but also struggles against injustice that kind of illuminated for me or helped me to understand the world as it was right now. And so that was kind of what brought me to the work, but also the way in which I always hope that the work is a tool or a way in which we can think about the past to kind of improve the present.
Well, yeah, I love that story because it's so much about the environments we put our children in matter, and it shapes our perspectives and our worldviews. And I remember you had done an interview, I think it was the New York Times, and they asked you, are you from Detroit, or just Detroit, right?
Right.
And you corrected them very quickly, and you said, I'm from Detroit. And I think that is definitely a part of who you are as a scholar very much. Now, there's a lot of social justice topics out there. Your first book was also on labor in Detroit. What is it that really attracted you to telling the Attica story in particular?
Well, in some respects, the whole story of coming to Attica is, it's not one I'm really proud of because it was never about prisons when I first started off. I think I, like most Americans, had very little knowledge of this huge apparatus that we fund and we put our faith in, and it swallows up such a great percentage of our citizenry, but yet we don't know anything about it. And sadly, even as a grown-up, I was one of those people. I came to Attica as a civil rights historian. I knew enough to know that there had been this important civil rights uprising in a prison. So I was interested in that. But I'd never been in a prison. I'd never thought much about prison. I didn't think I knew anyone in prison, although, of course, it turns out we all know people in prison, but we just don't think about it sometimes, or we don't talk about it. But it was the journey of doing that book was what I thought was just going to be a civil rights story became a story about the justice system and injustice in the justice system. But my journey to that, I think, was... It was a journey. I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't come to it thinking I want to write about prisons. I came to it thinking I want to write about a civil rights story. Yeah. And writing that book, I think, it just opened my eyes and prisons became important to me, and the justice system became important even beyond that book in the process of doing it.
And there was a real revelation process in the research that you did. But before we get to that, I think that maybe we'll spend a little bit of time talking about the extraordinary story you found, and maybe we can begin with the conditions inside the prison, inside Attica in particular, and the local jails that set up this really the tinderbox for the uprising that began in 1971. And then we'll move through the story a little bit with everybody. But I thought maybe I'd start with a couple words from the text for you all to kind of ground our conversation about the conditions inside the prison. So on page 8, she just really takes us from the very beginning right inside of Attica and really gives us a good look, a very sort of grounded, evidentiary, but also visceral feeling of what it was like to be incarcerated in Attica. So I want to share a few of the words and then hand it over to you to talk a little bit more about what the conditions were like inside. So here on page 8 it reads, "The men needed money at Attica because the state offered them only a few items gratis. These included a thin gray coat, 2 gray work shirts, 3 pairs of gray pants, 1 pair of shoes, 3 pairs of underwear, 6 pairs of socks, and 1 comb. Then every month prisoners would receive 1 bar of soap and 1 roll of toilet paper, which meant that men were forced to limit themselves to 1 sheet per day. The state's food budget allotment was also meager. At a mere 63 cents per prisoner per day, it was insufficient to meet the minimum dietary standards as determined by federal guidelines. The reality was that many men at Attica went to bed hungry. For this reason, jobs in the kitchen or the mess hall, while more arduous than others given their 7-day-a-week work schedule, were some of the most coveted. At least on those jobs, a man could eat the leftovers." So this is our first introduction to what it was like to be incarcerated at Attica. Mm-hmm. Can you take us a little bit more inside?
Yeah, one of the things about prison is that they are utterly closed institutions, and that's always been the case. In some respects, it's more the case today than it even was then, and so we don't have any clue kind of the unimaginable human rights violations that go on a daily basis, and some of those violations are at the most kind of basic level, you know, not even the torture or the actual physical abuse, but the real neglect and the deprivation. So yes, these guys were fed on too little money. They didn't have sufficient sanitary supplies. They didn't have any of the things that they really needed to just have a basic existence. But in addition to that, they were racially segregated. Whites got the best jobs. Blacks got the worst jobs. They were in fact abused on a regular basis, and they were kind of degraded in other ways. So for example, they couldn't read what they wanted to read. Things were censored. So Attica very improbably had subscriptions to House Beautiful and Field and Stream, but you couldn't read history, and you couldn't read philosophy, and you couldn't, you know, there's many things that people were barred from reading. Parole rules were completely capricious. You could get parole. People would work really hard to get parole, but then you were handed an out-of-date phone book and told that you had to write to a local employer, and when that employer hired you, you could leave. So needless to say, not too many people got jobs because not many people wanted to respond to an envelope, you know, from Attica, New York. But also it literally meant that people were incarcerated long past their release date. And if you spoke Spanish, there were no Spanish-speaking inmates, and many of the prisoners were Puerto Rican. So your mail would just get thrown out from your loved ones because they couldn't read it, so you couldn't read it. You couldn't see your children if you were in a common law marriage. So it was just kind of this grinding degradation. And I think what struck me as so remarkable about that was that there was still this amazing faith in the system. These guys were writing letters to the senator and to the commissioner of corrections and basically saying, can you just help us? Just some, we want to get out, but just can you give us some basic accommodation here? And so that when it all blows up, it's in large part because of this basic failure to deliver basic services, not because, I think as the state wanted to portray, that it was just this hotbed of troublemakers. I mean, there were really some militant guys there. There was Black Panthers there, Young Lords there. But even they were advocating for a very reasonable kind of accommodation, and it just wasn't happening.
Yeah, when I first read this book, one of the stories that always resonated with me was the fight that people had to undertake for eyeglasses.
Yeah.
So that they could just see and participate in their lives and in their world. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean is sort of about this kind of basic degradation. And in fact, you know, without jumping ahead too far, one of the most powerful ways in which this plays out when the state retakes the prison. I think one of the most horrific kind of things for me to read about was, again, I mean, the physical abuse was so bad, but it was this image of these state troopers coming in and taking people's eyeglasses off and taking their false teeth out and just smashing them with baseball bats and grinding them into the ground. And that kind of realization that that was the worst violence, because it was preventing someone from eating, it was preventing someone from being able to see. And that's in part why I think that the whole story was so eye-opening to me, because it's hard to imagine, you know, this is 1971, right? This is post the Voting Rights Act. This is, you know, this is after Selma. This is after the Montgomery bus boycott. And it's as if everything is frozen in time in this institution, and you know, horrific things happened.
Yeah. So you draw out this story where it's completely clear as to why there's so much frustration among the men who are in prison there, and why there would be this drive to take over the prison and list out a set of demands to change the conditions mm-hmm. of their world and of their lives, because their lives matter, right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what happens during the uprising, because those days alone are extraordinary in and of themselves. That I think many times we've been told about Attica as being complete chaos, mm-hmm. and that it's the savagery of the men who were inside. So we'll begin with a quick excerpt mm-hmm. from the book, but then maybe if you can take us inside what happens during the uprising. Okay. So on page 66, Heather takes us into some of the very first moments after the men take over the prison from the guards. And so these are some of the first actions that the men who were incarcerated took. In time, Champ, this is one of the men who was in prison, Champ's bullhorn was being used not just to spread calm and unity, but also to get practical things accomplished in D Yard. A prisoner skilled in electrical work managed to set up a speaker system, and everyone was soon listening as instructions were issued to immediately cease all drug taking, sexual acts, and hoarding of food and cigarettes. They were told to bring all weapons, any and all weapons, crowbars, iron pipes, knives, and put them under the table where the speaker stood. Dao Lu translated everything, every directive, into Spanish. So again, speaking back to the conditions that mm-hmm. these men who were incarcerated, many of them couldn't even understand the language of the place, mm-hmm. the directives they were given. And the prisoners, once they take over, they were creating a more human space. Right. Can you take us into the uprising?
So the reason why this whole thing becomes the rebellion that we now know about was completely by accident, frankly. It was not planned. It happened because the prison management made a series of very ill-fated decisions. And on the morning of the uprising, they decided to lock some prisoners in a hallway, not tell the guards what they were doing. Complete chaos ensues. And what I actually say in the book is that in those first moments, it actually is a riot by any definition of the word, right? Chaos, people are being hurt, people are scrambling to arm themselves with anything they can find because everyone is terrified. But what is so remarkable about this is exactly what you say. It's that, in fact, there was this incredible humanity at work. Everyone moved to one of the four exercise yards. There was a negotiating committee set up. Every cell block elected people to speak for them so that everybody would be represented. Everything was translated into Spanish. They set up a medical tent. They set up a food distribution tent. And they brought in all these observers to make sure that the state would negotiate with them in good faith. And they had taken hostages. These were guard hostages who, you know, you might, you'll see if you read it, their stories are also very woven throughout this book, because they end up being very victimized by the state as well. But they surround them with two rings of prisoners to make sure they're protected, to make sure they have mattresses to sleep on, to make sure that the tent city, if you will, the community that's set up in the yard, is one that people will feel safe and feel that they could be heard over the course of what will become four long days and four long nights, round-the-clock negotiations with the state. And you know, and it's remarkable because the media is there. You know, this is being broadcast to people across the country, and so America is watching this. And it really the first televised prison uprising ever. But that was strategic because the guys knew that these were closed institutions and they wanted to bring the public in. You know, this is what this is like. You know, we are people. And one of the most powerful spokesmen, a guy named L.D. Barkley, was 21. These guys were, L.D. was there for driving without a driver's license. You know, there were 17-year-olds in there, 18-year-olds in there, so many parole violators you can't imagine. And so as Americans, when we say Attica, we imagine the worst of the worst. I mean, Attica comes to mean like, oh, God, you know, Attica. And we all, you know, recoil. And what I discovered in the course of doing this book is that the fact that that is our reaction was part of the story. In other words, that's what was manufactured on the part of state officials. In fact, the people on the inside ended up being much more humane than the people on the outside. But we didn't understand that. We weren't told that, basically.
Well, I'd love to move into that part of the story because, believe it or not, the Attica uprising is really only 150 pages of this extraordinary book. The vast majority of this book is about the cover-up that followed, about the actions of the guards and their families and the formerly imprisoned to end the cover-up. And then, of course, we have to talk about your own work at getting at the history and getting into the archives. So there's the Attica uprising between, I believe, September 9th and September 13th mm-hmm. of 1971. Mm-hmm. And then you have the troopers, the state police, who storm the prison. For about 30 minutes, they retake the prison. Can you take us into those 30 minutes and tell us a bit about what happens, and then we'll get into the cover-up?
So imagine a situation where these guys have been negotiating around the clock. There's a team of observers to help them negotiate, comprised of both folks chosen by the prisoners, but also folks chosen by the governor, who was Governor Rockefeller, liberal Republican, someone who had a quite good reputation at the time. It's all going pretty well. In fact, there were 28 demands that were agreed to by the state, and everybody was imagining that these negotiations were going to go well and that we were going to be able to kind of end this. And right towards the end, everything fell apart over the issue of amnesty. The prisoners knew that they could not surrender without some measure of protection, right, so that they would not either be physically harmed or indiscriminately prosecuted legally. And the governor would not budge on that. And the lore that anyone at the time who remembers the story was that basically they had to storm the prison because they were at an impasse, it was a stalemate, and the prisoners were just being recalcitrant, they weren't going to give up. One of the things my research indicated was that, because I found some of these sort of smoking gun documents, was that the state had no intention of ending this peacefully. And that, in fact, the Rockefeller administration was going to go in. They didn't choose to send in the National Guards, who were actually trained for riot retaking in small spaces like prisons. They sent in the least trained state troopers from all over the state of New York. In fact, while these 4 days of negotiations were going on, every state trooper barrack in New York had descended upon Attica. So for the same days that those negotiations are going on, they are outside passing out guns like candy. Nobody's writing down serial numbers. In fact, one hapless trooper who's trying is told to rip it up. These guys are angry. They have not slept. They have not eaten. They are furious. They are itching to get in. And the observers say to Rockefeller, you can't retake the prison with these guys. And they use the words, it's going to be a massacre. And again, we were all told ultimately they had no choice. Well, now we know that they deliberately did not give these guys an ultimatum. So on the fifth morning, they tell these guys inside, release the hostages. They did that every day. It was the same conversation they'd had day after day. And the guys basically said, no, thank you. We're still in the middle of negotiations. And we now know that they deliberately didn't give them an ultimatum. And so imagine that you're in this yard. It is September 13th in upstate New York. It is cold. It is rainy. It is chilly. And then all of a sudden, they hear a helicopter revving up. And some of these guys are so naive and really so hopeful that they think Rockefeller's coming. Because they've begged him to come, basically. Come and just, if you can't give us amnesty, endorse that we can surrender, you know, with dignity. And mind you, there's 40 hostages in this place, state employees. And they had this faith, you cared about your own employees. You're not going to sacrifice your own employees. And so they hear the helicopter, and I take you in the story to what they decided to do, which is they planned this. The last-ditch effort, if the state's going to come in, we'll take some of the hostages up on the catwalks, which, you know, sit over the yards, and we're going to surround each of them with these so-called executioners, you know, makeshift knives or whatever. And some of the guards knew the plan, because the plan was we're going to, you know, remind them, right? If you're going to come in, you're killing your own. Like, remind the state what the stakes are. Which shows such a naivete, right? That they actually thought that would matter. And I take you up onto the catwalk where, for example, there's one of the guards, Mike Smith, and he's next to him is a prisoner, Don Noble, and they knew each other from working together in the metal shop. And they're terrified. They are sick. They are shaking. Their voices are quaking. They're ill because they don't know at all whether this plan is going to go well. They are exchanging information. You know, Mike is saying to Don, you know, if I don't get out of here, you know, deep in my left pocket, I've written a note to Sharon, my wife. Can you please give her this note and tell her I love her? They exchange their particulars, and right when that happens, then they hear the ominous sound of another helicopter revving up. And as Mike tells in the book, he says it was so deafening and so close that he says you could feel the concussion in your chest. And as these guys are just like literally trembling, the helicopter comes over and it douses the yard, which is, you know, 100 yards by 100 yards. It's not huge. And the catwalk with CN and CS gas, which is tear gas. But even I didn't know tear gas. You know, I'm imagining, you know, it's the 60s, you know, everybody got tear gassed at some point, right? But it was a misnomer because, in fact, it wasn't a gas. It's actually a powder, and it's a thick powder, and it was clinging to everybody's nasal passages and down their throats. So, in fact, when the gas comes over, and you can see this in film because the state troopers are filming everything, which is going to be important to the cover-up, it just mows them down. And as these guys are all retching and vomiting and blinded and falling to the ground, that's when hundreds of state troopers come in. Some of them have their personal weapons, state-issue weapons. They had taken off their badges, their identifying badges, before they went in. And it was all unimaginable horror after that. For 15 minutes, just this nonstop shooting while a helicopter is circling over saying, surrender with your hands up and you won't be harmed. Surrender with your hands up. And you can hear the helicopter in the film. You can hear that voice to the tune of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so in the end, there are 39 men, both prisoners and guards alike, who have been shot to death. And there's a total of 128 men who have been shot so severely, some of them 6-7 bullet wounds. And to make a very long story short, what then happens is one of the sort of worst things you could imagine, which is that state officials then go out to the public. And there's reporters there from everywhere. And they tell the American public that something very different happened. They said that the prisoners are the ones that have killed the hostages. And not only that, that they've castrated one of them and stuffed his testicles in his mouth. And not only that, but they'd already killed a few guards and buried them in the yard. And they had proof of it. They'd seen it. They even had film of it. And so America, who, by the way, had been sympathetic to prison decarceration, against the death penalty. I'm talking about polling. Against the death penalty, believed guards needed training, kind of overnight says, these guys are animals. These guys are barbaric. And so then what goes on in that prison for days, weeks, months is quite literally torture. And because they are going to be made to pay for having harmed the hostages. But at the end of the day, they hadn't killed any of these hostages on the 13th. They'd all been shot by law enforcement.
Yeah, and we'll get into the cover-up in a second, but I want to dig a little bit deeper into the racial dimensions mm-hmm. of this, because you spend quite a bit of time talking about the violence of the troopers when they stormed the prison, but that there was a special kind of violence and racial terror that was reserved for Black inmates in particular. And I think you tell the story so beautifully. I'll allow you to take it over. But can you talk about this dimension of race in the retaking of Attica?
You know, I think I will just say as a writer, I mean, I know that sometimes people are interested in the writing process. This was the hardest thing I've ever had to write. And the reason is because it's very difficult. I didn't know this before, but it's very difficult to write violence. Because you don't want to be too graphic, because then that's sort of gratuitous or almost, you know, you become numb to it. But you can't short shrift it because it's so important to the story. And I realized that what was most profoundly violent about it was, again, not the physical part of it, which is horrifically violent. You know, I mean, just violating men in the most unimaginable ways. But it was the racial violence, it was the verbal violence, it was the smashing of the eyeglasses and the smashing of the false teeth and you know, urinating into open wounds. But all of that was punctuated with racial violence. All of that was punctuated with racial epithets and forcing men with bullet wounds to get on their knees and give the white power salute, forcing people to crawl. There's so much glass everywhere because all the windows have been shot out. There's glass everywhere. They're stripping all these guys down and forcing them to crawl and run across this glass. And even the white prisoners, I mean, this is how racialized it was. There was, in fact, a lot of white prisoners in Attica. And there were a lot of Latino prisoners in Attica. But it didn't matter because they had stood with the blacks. And by standing with the blacks in that form of unity, they are deeply racialized. So the physical violence was made so much worse by that kind of, and so I find in the book, even though all the chapters are quite short, and actually the chapter on the retaking is, which is called No Mercy, and the next one is The Beat Goes On, they're very short chapters, but everyone that reads them, I think, will remember most those things, right? The kind of unforgivable acts that are not necessarily even physical.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have quotes from the guards who retook the prison saying things such as, "We haven't killed enough niggers. Keep your nigger nose down. Don't you know state troopers don't like niggers? Don't move, nigger, you're dead." Right? And they're saying this indiscriminately, mm-hmm. largely to black prisoners, but mm-hmm. to all, as you say.
And if you were black, marking with chalk on the back, big X's, so that they would be singled out for solitary confinement. You know, again, just really quickly fast forwarding to the end of the book, eventually these guys will be able to, I mean, they never give up trying to tell their story, and they eventually have a moment in civil court where they are able to finally get some of their stories on the record. And again, in that moment, some of the things that really struck me was it was one guy, and he'd already talked about all the physical things that had happened to him. But he says, "I looked up," and he says, "I've never seen that much hatred in blue eyes." And it just kind of took my breath away. And the other similar story to that was a guy, he gets up on the stand, he's finally going to be able to tell his story, but he takes forever to get up the dais because he's crippled, like he's not walking very well. And he finally gets up there and he says to the judge, "I'm really sorry, you know, it takes me a while to get up here." And he said, "No, that's okay, you know, does this relate, you know, tell me what happened." And this was a guy who was about 6'7", 6'8", and he was there for a very short stint, but he was actually going to be drafted by the NBA, and he was a star basketball player. And somehow the troopers knew this, and they took the butts of their rifles, and they broke every bone in his foot. So that he'd never be able to play basketball again. So that was to your point, I mean, it was sort of beyond retaking the prison, you know, beyond getting control of the prison.
And this massacre happened within the span of about 35 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And the stories that were spun and told about it began immediately right outside of the prison, but it continued for many, many, many years.
Yep.
Can you tell us about the cover-up that began? You already told us a bit about right outside of the prison, but even as the bodies were being taken to the morgue and the investigation that was going on with all the autopsies, there was a cover-up that happened right there.
You know, the thing is, of all the terrible stories in this book, there's also some incredibly heroic stories in this book and from some very unlikely quarters. And one of them was the coroner, the local coroner, who receives all these bodies. And he can quickly see their throats haven't been slit. They've all been shot. And the only people that have guns are the troopers. And he naively goes public with this. And this is after, by the way, he's doing the autopsies and the troopers are filled up his autopsy bay and trying to intimidate him. And they're showing up at the funeral homes and making funeral directors sign autopsies to say that the guards have not been shot. Saying to one of the wives of the widow, she wanted to know what had happened. One of the widows wanted to know what had happened to her husband. And the local funeral guy, they all know each other. It's a tiny town. Attica's a tiny town. And he brings her to the back. He calls her over and he's looking around terrified and he lifts up the sheet off of her husband so that she can see where he's been shot and he looks at her and goes like this, like don't tell them that I told you. But he went public. Rockefeller tried to completely, they said he was a communist. They sent in two other coroners to do autopsies who concurred that in fact those people had been shot. But the thing we have to understand is it didn't matter at that point. That story was on the front page of the New York Times that the prisoners had killed the hostages. It was on the front page of the LA Times. Mm-hmm. And most significantly, perhaps, the AP was there. So that story went out to every small town newspaper in America. My family, extended families from a tiny town in Kansas, Iola, Kansas, and I was there this summer giving a talk and my cousin, I said, I wonder if it was in the Iola Register, and sure enough, it was. So when I say it went out everywhere, I mean, that's how America sours on what had really happened, but they never give up, and they keep fighting back. There is an investigation. There's many investigations. There was a Justice Department investigation, and they couldn't find anything wrong. There was congressional investigations, and they couldn't find anything wrong, but the most kind of just shocking investigation was the state of New York's own investigation. And just really quickly, this is Rockefeller. He appoints the attorney general to look into Attica, what went wrong, because, you know, something's clearly gone wrong. There's a whole lot of dead people there. What happened? And he puts it in the Organized Crime Task Force unit because he wants to show this has been a leftist conspiracy. It's a very well-funded investigation, but even though the troopers have killed 39 people and shot 128 in total, they go after the prisoners. And they indict 62 of them. So a third of this book is about this incredible, really Herculean grassroots legal defense effort to make sure that the state is not able to put all this on the prisoners. It's an incredible, incredible legal story, like up there with the Scottsboro boys. And how were they able to do this, go after these prisoners? Because they allowed the same troopers that had retaken the prison to investigate the investigation. So there's no chalk markings of any bodies. The troopers scooped up all of the evidence in the yard that would have incriminated them. They buried it behind the prison. They spliced film. They doctored photographs. They altered trooper statements. And the upshot of this was not one state trooper is ever held legally responsible for what happens at Attica. And yet, America, who's first been told that the prisoners have killed the hostages like animals and barbarians, then for the next 5 years, they watch prisoners paraded across the news in handcuffs, right, because they've all been charged with these crimes. So send again the message that everything that was wrong with the civil rights movement in Attica and black people, and it's all about, you know, it's all playing out in front of their eyes. And you know, that I personally couldn't understand, like, how could that have happened? Like, I mean, I was, I guess, naive enough to say, I mean, I get why they wanted it to happen, but how did they pull it off? I mean, there's film of this. And so that's why so much of the book is about what you were referring to as the cover-up. And I have to say, as a historian, Kelly and I are both historians, we don't use that word. I mean, we are not conspiracy theorists as much as our students sometimes would like us to be. You know, really? Are you sure? No, I mean, we don't say that. You know, you can only say that if you have tangible evidence that people with power and control actively thwarted, or perverted justice. And I was able to, in this book, after 45 years, I was able to show that. And I think I was actually able to name the troopers who had been shooting people and actually killed people whose names had been protected for 45 years.
So that's one of the most incredible parts of this story. And I just also want to back up and say that, you know, Rockefeller had a meeting in his estate able to bring together all
that's
of
right.
the people to coordinate the cover-up. President Nixon was calling into Rockefeller, as you document here, saying,
right.
I'm in your corner 100% with the story that it was the blacks.
Nixon had one question. I mean, it's a bloodbath. And you can listen to the phone call. And he has one question for Rockefeller. Was it a black business? And Rockefeller says, why indeed, Mr. President, it was. Which, of course, it was not. And, the most threatening thing about it was precisely because it was multiracial. And without getting off on a tangent, I discovered that the FBI had been on the scene from the instant this prison uprising happened. And you have to understand why that is meaningful. Attica is a tiny town. This is a state prison. And I discovered teletypes that were being sent not just to the local FBI, but to the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Attorney General, the Vice President, the President. And then you kind of realize what's at stake here. Right. I mean, Rockefeller believed that this was a serious threat to national security, and they marshaled everything to dismantle it. And they don't win because they try. Part of what I discovered was these secret meetings in Rockefeller's pool house. You can't make this stuff up. His pool house in Pocantico Hills, where he's got at this meeting the head of the state police that have retaken the prison, the attorney general, his own guys. And for three different weekends right after the uprising, they're getting their story straight. They had a document listed called the Confidential Attica Memo that they denied the existence of this memo for at least 40 years, and I actually found a copy of it, which was how I was able to show this. But it was just, so when I was able to write the words cover up, it was like, even the attorneys, they went, are you sure? Can we, yes, it's really there.
Yeah, and I just have one more question, then we'll definitely open it up for a bigger conversation. But can you talk to us a little bit about the research process here, that this is a set of documents that was intentionally set aside or hidden away so that the formerly incarcerated and the families of the guards couldn't bring this evidence to court, right, to win their cases, which in the end they do, in fact. Can you tell us a little bit about how you found these records and uncovered this story?
Yeah, I think just really quickly, the thing that I need to say before that is just what we do as historians, the way we tell these stories is that we go to an archive, we go to a library, we ask for, box 40, folder 2, whatever. And from all of that collected evidence, we recreate and piece together the past. And that's how we rescue the past, and that's how we share it, and that's how we learn from it. In the case of Attica, but most importantly, in the case of countless other stories from this time period that have to do particularly with any civil rights unrest, any kind of justice struggles of any nature, we don't have access to those records. And in fact, in the case of Attica, they were actively kind of sequestered. And I didn't know this, of course, when I got the book contract. That was a bit of a shock. Whoops. And so the book takes 13 years to write, in part because I've got to, recreate the archive. And Kelly's had to do this in her own work, too. I mean, you use the phrase rebel archive, and that's such a powerful phrase because it's how do you create the story when the people who made the story don't want you to know it. And so you have to completely rethink how you do this kind of research. And thankfully, because the prisoners and the guards keep on speaking, they refuse to be shut down. The state says nothing happened. It was just a fraternity hazing. These guys keep saying, yes, something happened. You know, I can't walk. And so they keep on talking. So I was able to tell it because of the prisoner stories. I was able to tell it because of the guards and the judges and the lawyers. I mean, you know, everyone helped me to recreate that archive. But at the end of the day, I couldn't still figure out what had happened to the police. I mean, that had pretty effectively been shut down. And so the very quick kind of story about how that happened, and it scares me to tell it to you because it was so accidental. And had it not happened this way, we wouldn't know three quarters of the book, which worries me of how much of the rest of this period we don't know about. I had been calling every small town courthouse in upstate New York to find Attica records because I knew there had been these criminal trials of the prisoners, and I knew somewhere there had to be records. But I didn't know enough to really know even where to look. I didn't know the litigants' names. I didn't know the case numbers. So it was just a complete shot in the dark. And one day I got a call from the Erie County Courthouse. Some woman says, you know, I think we do have some Attica records here. And, of course, I, you know, was a very low-paid professor back in North Carolina at the time. And, you know, it's not easy to just get on a plane with little kids. But I got on a plane because I was so shocked that there might be Attica records. And what it was, clearly she didn't know what she had. They didn't know what they had. I walked into this dusky back room, and on a huge wall, floor to ceiling, was just a blizzard of papers. And I started just pulling papers out. And I was like, oh, my God. It was everything. Grand jury testimony, trooper statements, autopsies. I mean, it was just shocking, and I was afraid. This is, you know, I'm looking around. Are there cameras? What's going on? You know, and I'm also kind of panicked because I realize how significant this is, and I don't quite know how I'm going to possibly take notes from all this. I mean, there's no desk. You know, I don't have a computer. This is even before we have little tiny laptops. My students today say, "Why didn't you scan it with your phone?" It was 2006. We didn't have smartphones. I had the little flip Nokia. That wasn't on. But when I really realized how significant it was, this is another just fluke. I pull out what was a whistleblowing document. One of the reasons why the trial shut down is because an inside guy, a prosecutor, understands that that there's been a cover-up. He understands that. He's got evidence against the troopers, and he's not allowed, he feels, to prosecute them. Why? Because now Rockefeller is sitting to be the vice president of the United States. And that's when the whole thing gets shut down. And he becomes a whistleblower. And to do that, he wrote a document. It was 167 pages where he pulled together all the evidence that he had against the troopers, including their names and their crimes and what they did. And there was three copies of it. And I knew him. I'd met him, but he's a very ethical man. He would never give it to me because he was an attorney and it was a private document. And that was there. And the other thing that was there was that confidential document from Rockefeller's office. And I knew, like, oh, my God. And so I had to figure out how I was going to get it out of there. And for a moment, I contemplated grand theft myself. But the truth is, having been in a prison, one never, ever really wants to go to one. But joking aside, I mean, it was really a problem because I knew I did not have any confidence that this stuff would not disappear the next day. And so I thought I would ask to Xerox them, and I think back on the naivete of this. So they said, well, I guess that would be fine, but it wasn't really a file. It was just chaos. They didn't even know what are you asking to Xerox? We don't even know. Please go see the clerk of the court, who's an elected guy, and ask him what you should do. And I still feel very guilty about this. Kelly's heard this story before, but I still live with great guilt. I acknowledge him in the book because I feel so guilty. I'm sure he's not pleased with the acknowledgement. But I went to his office, and, you know, it's an elected position. He was very coiffed and, you know, kind of, you know, you just know, a very a politician. And And I said, you know, you do. It turns out you do have Attica records, and I might have said I was working on a paper, not a book, and I might have said I was a history teacher, not a professor. I don't know, but I tried to kind of say, can I, you know, I'd like to make, you know, I'd like to be able to make some copies for my book report. No, I didn't say that. you know, I'm just trying to figure. And he says, well, you know, I think that would be fair. I think you could probably, you know, we could probably arrange for you to do some Xeroxing. And then I realized that Xeroxing, because it's a courtroom, it's $1.50 a page. Yeah. And I, you know, at the time, I'm probably making $1.50 an hour myself. So I'm like, that's not going to happen. And so I said, well, I'm a history teacher. I just probably can't afford that. And he said, well, what do you think would be fair? And I said, well, what if I wrote you a check for $200 to just Xerox whatever I could, which was very important in retrospect because I have a check that we used to write checks. I have a canceled check, which is important because he said, okay. And then he said, so you have to hand all this stuff to, I don't remember her name, you know, Marge, and she's going to Xerox it for you. And I thought, oh, God. No, because you know, anyone can see it says in the special grand jury of the state of New York, and anybody will know that these are important documents. And so I went back into the room and I buried the important documents amidst all kinds of unimportant documents. And I took out a huge stack and I took one look at the Xerox machine. It was that kind where you lift up the lid, it's like, And it was just awful. And so basically what I did at that point, I mean, there is a humorous part to this, which is she starts to Xerox, and every time we get near a, you know, smoking gun document, I just start jabbering. Oh, my God, is that your granddaughter? Oh, my God, blue eyes. You know, that shirt, did you get Target? I know, right? I saw that last week, and I wanted it in blue, but they didn't have it in large. But you guys, and I talk so maniacally that this woman is just like, She's trying to get me, you know, get me out of there. But anyway, so I got all those documents ultimately, which allowed me to tell the story. But you should know the two things. One, God knows what was on that shelf I didn't get, number one. And number two, right before the book came out, which was embargoed, the book was embargoed because I was so afraid, you know, that someone would try to shut it down. I didn't want anyone to see it till it was actually out. And I got a recall from a reporter who said, so I hear that you got all these important Attica documents out of Erie County. And again, the uncharitable part of me was like, you're kidding me. I've worked on this for 13 years and you're going to waltz right in there and you're going to put this in your, but you know, the truth was I was really afraid that if he tipped them off, those were going to disappear. And so he calls me a week later and he's furious. He says, I called them up and I told them what I wanted. And they said they don't have Attica documents. They've never had Attica documents. And I said, let me guess, you called and you told them what I had that you wanted. And then they called him a week later and said, well, actually, we do have some Attica documents. And they handed him a box, this yay big, and it was the indictments of all the prisoners. And that's all they had. And the reason why that is significant is because you have to remember that huge wall of documents. That means that somebody had to go through every single piece of paper and only pull out what was public anyway, which was the indictments and the things that would condemn the prisoners. So those have all disappeared. All those documents are gone.
Within the last 13 years.
And likely in the last year.
Right. So right? This cover-up continues.
All the artifacts that were turned over in 2011 to the New York State Museum that I also got to see. I got to see, like, the bloody clothes I was picking. It was just, anyway, those have all also been pulled off the shelves. So, yeah. So, you know, it is still ongoing. And for any of us who do this kind of work, whether, you know, we're historians or attorneys or whoever, it really does resonate today, because when we think about even, for example, police shootings today, and you look at it and you think, well, why wasn't that person indicted? And you know, Attica really explains to you, like, why it's so hard to get those indictments. But in turn, even if someone is indicted, why is there no evidence? Why is there no ability to actually bring these cases? And, you know, it's a little humbling when you recognize how important those records are to it. Anyway.
Yeah, and what your book also does, and you lay out in the epilogue, is why Attica matters, mm-hmm. right, as a story in the making of mass incarceration across the country, that with the storytelling and the narrative about what the imprisoned had done, all false, also came this cultural shift toward punishment in the United States, that we have been heading toward ending the death penalty and reducing the size of the prison population. But after Attica, there is a cultural shift toward greater retribution and punishment for those who are imprisoned. So if we had invested in rehabilitation, we now more are invested in punishment and removing rights from people who are incarcerated and formerly incarcerated.
And not seeing them as human. And I think what was so moving to me, you know, this is a horrible story in this book, but I didn't end it, I don't think, on a horrible note. I end it with the sort of more optimistic view that what Attica really shows is kind of the irrepressible spirit of human beings to be treated as human. I mean, no matter what they've done wrong, to no matter who they are, that, you know, because no matter what everybody did wrong in this story, people never went away. They continued to tell their story. And the day the book came out, or actually that week, which was the 45th anniversary of Attica, 40,000 prisoners from across the United States launched a day of work stoppages and protests. And, you know, that's humbling, because it does remind us that, you know, right now we have 2.5 million people still in our prisons, more than any other country on the globe. We have more children serving life sentences than any other country on the globe. We have more people serving solitary confinement than any other country on the globe. More hours, more years, more days. And we got to explain how we got here, because if we don't, you know, we won't be able to figure out our way out of here, or at least that's my view.
Well, it's a testament too, also to dogged research and scholars. So,
and a lot of good
luck for telling the story. And now I think we have time for a few questions, and they're walking around with handheld mics.
Thank you for your tenacity and your commitment to the truth and your journalistic integrity. Second, were you able to talk to any survivors, and was there ever any restitution for them? And were you ever able to talk to any of the guards, and did anybody ever tell you the truth? Does anybody have any remorse?
Yes and yes. The extraordinary part of the story is that it brought me, this research journey brought me into living rooms from New York City to the tiniest towns in upstate New York, both of guards and prisoners. And I heard a lot of stories, and everybody was traumatized after it. I mean, including some of the troopers that were sent in there, you know, permanently traumatized by what they had been asked to do, the position that they were put in. The guards were traumatized themselves. I even failed to tell the story. The guards, not only were their husbands killed and you know, people died and were wounded and maimed, the state then swindled them out of their ability to sue. They showed up at all their houses and, you know, here's a little check for you, Mrs. Cunningham with 8 kids. And never told them that if they cashed those checks, and this is in the weeks and months after their loved ones had died, that they would be statutorily ineligible to sue their employers. So they were swindled for 30 years, traumatized, post-traumatic stress disorder. So they both kind of, this is both of their stories, and they both hold the state accountable ultimately. They both end up with settlements from the state, and that's the last third of the book. So it does... They do, I think, reckon with all this. The problem is the state of New York still hasn't admitted any culpability. They've paid the money, but they still don't say they did anything wrong.
My roommate, 45 years ago, co-wrote a book with Herman Badilla.
Oh, yes. One of the Attica observers, former congressman, Herman Badillo.
So you've answered the question. Any comment on his role in it? It was very, I got the first read of the draft. So
that Haney. Yeah. Right? Milton Haynes?
Milton Haynes.
Milton Haynes, that's right. Yes, so Herman Badillo was one of the observers and was a remarkable man. His book was called A Time to Die. His quote was A Time to Die that Tom Wicker used. What was the name of his book? It was a memoir. It was very, very powerful, and I actually got to interview him before he died and to talk about Attica. And he, like every other observer, I talked to Tom Wicker, I talked to Herman Badillo, Clarence Jones, and I think I can safely say that every human being I talked to that experienced this just completely broke down at some point in the interview, which was really a testament to how traumatizing this was to everyone. For someone like Herman Badillo, and you know, he's a U.S. congressman, and he doesn't feel safe in this prison when they retake the prison, because he feels like anybody, particularly if you're Puerto Rican, you know, if you're black, your life is in danger too. And it was just traumatizing. And so he was a really remarkable, remarkable figure in this.
Hi, I was not in Attica, but I actually knew guys who were. Mm-hmm. And one from downstate New York insists I was there because I sound like the guys from Attica. You know, it's a question of accent. Anyway, what I'm saying is that how can we be against capital punishment? And I'm not including policemen killing suspects on the way to the prison, but have such a high rate of incarceration, and including your parole people who are on indefinite, they're just there. They don't have years to serve or anything like that. They're just held at the whim of the court. Mm-hmm. But how we can condone that, and we have more people than China or more people than Cuba, or I mean, when we're going around, you know, talking about people's rights, how in the world can we condone this, having so many people locked up? And locking them up doesn't prepare them for anything. If anything, it produces a skill set that is completely opposite of anything on the outside.
Right. Well, the answer is we cannot. And, I think it is unconscionable to have a society where you decide that all social ills and all problems that people face will be handled and settled and solved through the criminal justice system. And we made that decision 40 years ago as a nation. You know, before 1972, the prison rate in this country was remarkably stable over the entire history of this country, even though the crime rate went up and down. And after 72, the incarceration rate went through the roof, even though the crime rate still went up and down. And you know, it only can happen if we don't see what's happening inside. We don't care about who's happening inside. We've accepted that whoever's inside must have deserved their fate, or you know, do the crime, do the time. And the thing about a book like Attica, or any visit inside of a prison, or any discussion with anyone who's ever served time, is that you realize it's just not that simple, and that this is not the solution. It's that it is part of the problem. So yeah, I agree with you.
Thank you very much for coming, Professor. I read your book about 2 months ago, and it's a breathtaking book.
Oh, thank you.
I was riding in the bus, and many times it left me in tears, so thank you very much. Oh. I have so many questions, but I'd like to just give you two. One is, I'd like you to address, if you don't mind, the role of William Kunstler, mm-hmm, when he talks to the prisoners and maybe creates some sort of anticipation or expectation that's not going to happen, mm-hmm, because he is so militant, let's say that. And the second question I have for you is, we see the coming together at the end of the book of the prisoners and their survivors, as well as the troopers and their survivors. And so for this moment in time in upstate New York, you have sort of the black-white divide being diminished somewhat. And I want to know whether that really is meaningful or that was just momentary.
Oh, that's a great question. So first of all, William Kunstler, I failed to mention this to the group here, but William Kunstler famed civil rights, Marxist civil rights lawyer, was one of the Attica observers. And midway through the negotiations, he actually offers his services to the prisoners that he will be their attorney, which does muddy the waters a little bit because he's an observer and now he's just said he'll be their attorney. And he did come under quite a bit of fire at Attica because he was accused of at one point in suggesting to them that basically that they might have the ability to, he says something like, you know, countries like Algeria and so forth, you know, they're following your struggle. And there is some intimation that rather than persuading them that what was really at stake and that they should give up, that he was giving them hope that they should stick to the plan. I have to just say that I think he actually took a tremendous amount of flack that I don't think is actually quite fair, because once we know that they were going to go in anyway, which we do now know, in some respects blaming it on the radical attorney in the yard is the red herring that I'm hoping the book itself kind of takes us away from. You know, he got people riled up, so did, you know, some of the other observers. On the other hand, he was the one at the end that kept saying to them, look, this is the best deal you're going to get. This is the best deal you're going to get. And so I think we lose the focus here. And the focus was on the guys in the suits sitting in Albany and sitting in this wealthy house in Pocantico Hills who were playing with the lives of working class white and black New York citizens without regard. And to that point, you're right. The guards end up at some moments coming together with the prisoners because they both recognize it's a very perilous relationship, but they do both recognize one thing, which is that the state didn't care about either one of them and that the state screwed them both. But one of the sad parts about the story is that that relationship was so tenuous and so fraught. There are moments when some of them come together. One of the daughters of a slain corrections officer, William Quinn, becomes very close with one of the main prisoners, Big Black. There are those relationships. But at the end of the day, they didn't ever actually join together. And there is some thought, at least among some of both the guards and the prisoners, that had they actually stood together for real, and that they could have both had a lot more from the state. So, yeah, it has that glimpse, but it ultimately feels, I think, a little bit sad. But thank you for your comments on the book.
Thank you so much for your research and your scholarship. Could you talk briefly about the activist Sam Melville?
So Sam Melville was one of the prisoners in Attica. Some of you might know him because he was known by the prison officials as the Mad Bomber, but he got the acronym because he was part of the Weather Underground and had landed in Attica because he was a very vocal activist against the Vietnam War. And the reason why he becomes such a powerful Attica voice is because prior to the rebellion, he had been doing a lot of education, helping to educate prisoners about the broader kind of world out there and politics. And the guards hated him, and the state officials hated him. And he ends up killed during the retaking. And it's very controversial because every prisoner says he was assassinated, quite literally, and that the state always denied it. And one of the other things that my book revealed was not only was he killed by a trooper, but the trooper admitted it, and the trooper was actually part of the BCI, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, who then investigated the shooting. Wow. And his son, incidentally, lives in Los Angeles, and he's actually writing a book about his dad, so we'll also hear more about that.
Well, I think this is another example of a great conversation that goes way too fast. I want to thank all of you for coming out here tonight, to thank the Library Foundation of Los Angeles for hosting and sponsoring this conversation, and most of all, I want to thank you for coming to the West Coast to be with us and share your incredible work.
Thank you,
everyone.
Thank you, Kelly.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.